The part that divided her pigtails was wildly uneven, as if it had been made by a drunken finger rather than a comb. The boys had wandered off in opposite directions. For a second, she caught sight of Cal standing on the conveyor belt of a luggage carousel 3 carousels away, gliding by with the bags from Houston. No sooner had she seen him than he hopped off to avoid the charge of an oncoming skycap. "Cal!" Beverly called out over the crowd. She couldn't yell at him, not publicly, not at a distance, so she said, "Go get your brother." But Cal looked back at her, as if it were some weird coincidence that his name was Cal, and this complete stranger had said something to someone who was also named Cal. He turned away. Jeanette stood just beside her, looking at the strap of her little shoulder bag, staring at it. Had anyone had this child tested? Finally, every last bag from the nonstop TWA flight from Los Angeles to Dulles had slid onto the conveyor belt and been pulled away by the waiting travelers. There was nothing left to claim. The crowd dispersed, and she caught sight of Albie trying to pry an ancient piece of chewing gum off the floor with what, from a distance, almost looked like a knife. She turned away. "Okay," she said, calculating the time of day and the traffic back to Arlington. "I guess the bags didn't make the flight. That's not a problem. We'll just have to go to the office and fill out some paperwork. Did you keep the claim checks?" she said to Holly. Best to just direct everything to Holly, who seemed to have a natural desire to please. Holly was her only real chance. "We don't have any claim checks," Holly said. She had very pale skin and dark, straight hair, a face full of freckles. She had the kind of Pippi Longstocking looks adults found charming and other kids made fun of. "But you had them at some point. Didn't your mother give you the claim checks?" Holly started again. "We don't have any claim checks because we don't have any luggage." "What do you mean you don't have any luggage?" "I mean, we don't have any." Holly didn't see how she could be any clearer than that. "You mean you forgot it in Los Angeles? You lost it?" Beverly was distracted. She was looking for Cal and didn't see him. There were signs every 10 feet warning people not to sit or stand on the carousels. Holly's lip trembled slightly, but her stepmother failed to notice. Holly had thought there was something fishy about taking a trip without bags, but her mother had assured her this was the way their father wanted it. He wanted them to have everything new. New clothes, new toys, new bags in which to carry home the loot. Maybe he'd just forgotten to tell Beverly. "We didn't bring any," she said quietly. Beverly looked down at her. Goddamn Bert for saying she could manage this, no problem. "What?" It was terrible to have been made to say it once, unforgivable to be made to say it again. Tears welled up in Holly's eyes and started to run across the freckles. "We don't have any luggage." Now she would be in trouble with her father, and she hadn't even seen her father yet. What was worse, her father would be mad at her mother again. Her father had been calling her mother irresponsible forever, but she wasn't. Beverly's eyes shot from one end of the baggage claim to the other. The passengers and the people who had met them were thinning out. 2 of her stepchildren were missing, the 3rd stepchild was crying, and the 4th was so consumed by the vinyl strap of her handbag, it was hard not to assume she was handicapped.
"Then why have we been standing at the baggage carousel for the last half hour?"
Beverly didn't raise her voice. She wasn't mad yet. She'd be mad later, when she had time to think about it. But for now, she simply didn't understand.
"I don't know!"
Holly screamed, her eyes streaming. She pulled up the hem of her T-shirt and wiped it across her nose.
"It's not my fault! You brought us down here! I never said we had luggage!"
Jeanette unzipped the zipper on her little purse, dug around, and handed her sister a tissue. Every year, Beverly's 2nd trip to the airport was worse, because she always thought it was going to be better. She left her 4 stepchildren at home, first with her mother, then Bonnie, then Wallace, and now under Cal's supervision. They stayed home alone in Torrance, after all, and Arlington was safer than Torrance. and drove back to Dulles to reclaim her girls. While Bert's children came east for the entire summer, Caroline and Franny traveled west for 2 short weeks, one with Fix and then one with her parents. Just enough time to remind the girls how greatly they preferred California to Virginia. They shuffled off the plane looking like they were in an advanced state of dehydration from having cried for the entirety of their flight. Beverly dropped to her knees to hug them, but they were nothing but ghosts. Caroline wanted to live with her father. She begged for it. She pleaded. And year after year, she was denied. Caroline's hatred for her mother radiated through the cloth of her pink camp shirt as her mother pressed Caroline to her chest. Franny, on the other hand, simply stood there and tolerated the embrace. She didn't know how to hate her mother yet, but every time she left her father crying in the airport, she came that much closer to figuring it out. Beverly kissed their heads. She kissed Caroline again as Caroline pulled away from her.
"I'm so glad you're home," she said.
But Caroline and Franny were not glad they were home. They were not glad at all. It was in this battered state that the Keating girls returned to Arlington to be reunited with their step-siblings. Holly was certainly friendly. She hopped up and down and actually clapped her hands when the girls came through the door. She said she wanted to put on another dance recital in the living room this summer. But Holly was also wearing Caroline's red T-shirt with a tiny white ribbon rosette at the neck, which her mother had made Caroline put in the Goodwill bag before she left because it was both faded and too small. Holly was not the Goodwill. Caroline had the bigger room with 2 sets of bunk beds, and Franny, being smaller, had the smaller room with twin beds. The 2 sisters were connected by neither love nor mutual affinity, but by a very small bathroom that could be entered from the bedroom on either side. 2 girls and 1 bathroom was a workable situation from the beginning of September through the end of May, but in June, when Caroline and Franny returned from California, they found Holly and Jeanette had made themselves at home in 1 set of bunk beds, while Franny had lost her room completely to the boys. It was 4 girls in 1 room, and the 2 boys in the other, with a bathroom the size of a phone booth for the 6 of them to share. Caroline and Franny lugged their luggage up the stairs. Luggage. That which is to be lugged. They passed the open door of the master bedroom where Cal was lying across their mother's bed, his dirty feet in dirty socks resting on the pillows, watching a tennis match at top volume. They were never allowed to go into the master bedroom or sit on the bed, even if they kept their feet on the floor, nor were they allowed to watch television without an express invitation. Cal didn't lift his eyes from the screen or give the smallest recognition of their arrival as they passed. Holly was behind them, close enough to bump when they stopped walking.
"I was thinking that the 4 of us could dance in white nightgowns. Would that be okay? We could start practicing this afternoon. I've got some ideas about the choreography if you want to see."
As for there being 4 girls in the dance recital, only 3 were in evidence. Jeanette was MIA. No one had noticed she was gone. But Franny's cat, Buttercup, was missing as well. Buttercup had not come to the door to greet Franny, as surely she would have after 2 weeks away. Buttercup, the lifeline to normalcy, was gone. Beverly, drowning in the sea of child life, had no clear memory of the last time she'd seen the cat. But Franny's sudden, paralyzing sobs prompted her to do a thorough search of the house. Beverly found Jeanette beneath a comforter on the floor in the back of the linen closet. How long had Jeanette been missing? She was petting the sleeping cat.
"She can't have my cat," Franny cried.
And Beverly leaned down and took the cat from Jeanette, who hung on for only a half second and then let go. The entire time, Albie followed Beverly around the house doing what the children referred to as the stripper soundtrack. Boom, chick-a-boom, boom, boom, chick-a-boom. When their mother stopped walking, the soundtrack stopped. If she took a single step, it was accompanied by Albie saying only, "Boom," in a voice that was weirdly sexual for a 6-year-old. She meant to ignore him, but after a while, he proved too much for her. When finally she snapped, screaming, "Stop that!" he only looked at her. He had the most enormous brown eyes, and loose, loopy brown curls that made him look like a cartoon animal.
"I'm serious,"
she said, making an effort to steady her breathing.
"You have to stop that."
She tried to find within her own voice a sound that was reasonable, parental, but when she turned to walk away, she heard the small, quiet chug.
Boom, chicka-boom.
Beverly thought about killing him. She thought about killing a child. Her hands were shaking. She went to her room, wanting to close the door and lock it and go to sleep, but from the hallway she heard the thwack of a tennis ball, the roar of a crowd. She stuck her head around the doorframe.
"Cal,"
she said, trying not to cry.
"I need my room now."
Cal didn't move. Not a twitch. He kept his eyes on the screen. "It's not over," he said, as if she had never seen a tennis match before and didn't understand that when the ball was in motion, it meant the game was still going on. Bert didn't believe in television for children. At its most harmless, he saw it as a waste of time, a bunch of noise. At its most harmful, he wondered if it didn't stunt brain development. He thought Teresa had made a huge mistake letting the children watch so much TV. He had told her not to do it, but she never listened to him when it came to parenting, when it came to anything. That's why he and Beverly had only one television in this house, and why it was in their bedroom, which wasn't open to children, or wasn't open to her children during the regular course of the year. Now Beverly wanted to unplug the television and cart it off to what the realtor had called the family room, though no member of the family ever seemed to light there. She went down the hallway. Albie followed at a safe distance, churning his music.
Did his mother teach him that? Someone taught him. 6-year-olds didn't hang out in strip clubs, not even this one.
Beverly went into the girls' room, but Holly was there reading Rebecca.
"Beverly, have you ever read Rebecca?"
Holly asked as soon as Beverly stepped into the room, her little face bright, bright, bright.
"Mrs. Danvers is scaring me to death, but I'm going to keep reading it. I don't care if I had the chance to live in Manderley. I wouldn't stay there if someone was being that creepy to me."
Beverly nodded slightly and backed out of the room. She thought about trying to lie down in the boys' room, the room that had once been Franny's, but it had a vaguely nutty smell, reminiscent of socks and underwear and unwashed hair. She went downstairs again and found Caroline banging around the kitchen in a rage, saying she was going to make brownies for her father and mail them to him so he'd have something to eat.
"Your father doesn't like nuts in his brownies," Beverly said.
She didn't know why she said it. She was trying to be helpful.
"He does, too,"
Caroline said, turning on her mother so fast she spilled half a bag of flour on the counter.
"Maybe he didn't when you knew him, but you don't know him anymore. Now he likes nuts in everything."
Albie was in the dining room. She could hear him singing through the kitchen door. His single-pointed focus was astounding. Franny was in the living room, pulling the cat's front legs through the armholes of a doll's dress and crying so quietly that her mother was sure that every single thing she had ever done in her life up until that moment was a mistake. There was no place to go, no place to get away from them, not even the linen closet, because Jeanette hadn't come out of the linen closet since surrendering the cat. Beverly took the car keys and went outside. The minute she closed the door behind her, she was underwater, the summer air hot and solid in her lungs. She thought about the back patio of the house in Downey, how she would sit outside in the afternoons, Caroline on her tricycle, Franny happy in her lap, the smell of the orange blossoms nearly overwhelming. Fix had had to sell the house in order to pay her half of what little equity they had and make the child support. Why had she made him sell the house? No one could sit outside in Virginia. She got 5 new mosquito bites just walking to the driveway, and each one puffed up to the size of a quarter. Beverly was allergic to mosquito bites. It was easily 105 degrees inside the car. She started the engine, turned on the air conditioner, turned off the radio. She lay across the scorching green vinyl of the bench seat so that no one looking out the front window of the house could see her. She thought about the fact that if she were in the garage rather than the carport, she'd be killing herself now. Because California public schools ran slightly longer than Virginia Catholic schools, Beverly and Bert had had 5 days alone in the house between her children's departure and his children's arrival. One night after dinner, they made love on the dining room carpet. It wasn't comfortable. Beverly's weight had steadily dropped since their move to Virginia, and the bony protrusions of her vertebrae and clavicles were so clearly displayed she could have found work in an anatomy class. Every thrust pushed her back a quarter inch, dragging her skin against the wool blend. But even with the rug burns, it made them feel daring and passionate. It hadn't been a mistake, Bert kept telling her as they lay on their back afterwards, staring up at the ceiling. Beverly counted 5 places where the glass crystals on the chandelier were missing. She hadn't noticed it before.
Everything that's happened in our lives up until now, everything we've done, it had to happen exactly the way it did so that we could be together.
Bert took her hand and squeezed it.
You really believe that? Beverly asked.
We're magic, Bert said.
Later that night, he rubbed Neosporin down the length of her spine. She slept on her stomach. That was their summer vacation. Here was the most remarkable thing about the Keating children and the Cousins' children. They did not hate one another, nor did they possess one shred of tribal loyalty. The Cousinses did not prefer the company of the Cousinses, and the two Keatings could have done without each other entirely. The 4 girls were angry about being crowded together into a single room, but they didn't blame each other. The boys, who were always angry about everything, didn't seem to care that they were in the company of so many girls. The 6 children held in common one overarching principle that cast their potential dislike for one another down to the bottom of the minor leagues. They disliked the parents. They hated them. The only one who was troubled by this fact was Franny, because Franny had always loved her mother. During the regular part of the year, they sometimes took naps together in the afternoon after school, spooning so close they fell asleep and dreamed the same dreams. Franny would sit on the closed toilet lid in the mornings and watch her mother put on makeup, and she would sit on the toilet lid again at night and talk to her mother while her mother soaked in the bath. Franny was secure in the knowledge that she was not only her mother's favorite daughter, she was her mother's favorite person. Except in the summer, when her mother looked at her as if she were nothing more than the 4th of 6 children. When her mother was sick of Albie, she announced that all the children had to go outside, and all children included Franny. Ice cream had to be eaten outside, watermelon outside. Since when had she not been trusted to eat watermelon at the kitchen table? It was insulting. And not just to her. Maybe Albie couldn't eat a dish of ice cream without dropping it on the floor, but the rest of them were perfectly capable. They went outside, all right. They went outside and slammed the door and took off down the street, loping across the hot pavement like a pack of feral dogs. The 4 cousins' children didn't blame Beverly for their miserable summers. They blamed their father, and would have said so to his face had he ever been around. Cal and Holly gave no indication that they thought Beverly's behavior was inexcusable, and Jeanette never said anything anyway, and Albie, well, who knew about Albie? But Caroline and Franny were horrified. Their mother made everyone line up in the kitchen according to age and come to the stove with their plate, instead of putting the food on the table in dishes, as she did every other night of the year. In the summers, they wandered out of the civilized world and into the early orphanage scenes of Oliver Twist. It was a Thursday night in July when Bert called a family meeting in the living room and announced that in the morning they were going to Lake Anna. He told them he had taken the next day off from work and rented 3 rooms at the Pinecone Motel. On Sunday morning, they would drive to Charlottesville to see his parents and then come home again.
It's a vacation, Bert said. All arranged.
The children blinked, vaguely stirred to think of a day that wasn't going to be like all the other days, and Beverly blinked because Bert hadn't mentioned any of this to her. The children could see Beverly trying to catch Bert's eye, but Bert's eye could not be caught. A motel? A lake? Meals in restaurants? A visit to Bert's extremely unwelcoming parents, who had horses and a pond, and a fabulous black cook named Ernestine, who had taught the girls how to make pies the summer before. If the children had been inclined to speak to the parents, they might have said it sounded like fun. But they weren't inclined, so they didn't. The next morning, it was hot as a swamp. The birds stayed quiet in an effort to conserve their energy. Bert told the children to go and get in the car, though everyone knew it wasn't as simple as that. First, there would have to be an ugly fight over who had to sit with Albie, and they all stood around in the driveway waiting for it. The front seat, which was restricted to parents, was never an option, even though Caroline and Franny rode there with their mother all the time in the regular parts of the year. That left the back seat, the way back, and the way, way back of the wagon. In the end, the children were always arranged in pairs by gender or age, which meant that either Cal or Jeanette got stuck with Albie. Occasionally, Franny. Never Caroline or Holly. Albie would sing an impassioned version of 99 bottles of beer on the wall, in which the numbers did not diminish sequentially. 57 bottles, 78 bottles, 4, 104. He would talk about how he was going to be carsick, and make convincing gagging noises that forced Bert to the shoulder of the interstate for no reason, although Jeanette inevitably threw up, never having said anything about it. At every exit sign, Albie would ask if that was the exit they were supposed to take. "Are we there yet?" he would say, then burst out laughing at the pleasure of it all. No one wanted to sit with Albie. Just as they were starting to shove one another around the driveway, Bert came out, carrying a canvas bag the size of a shoebox. Bert was a very light packer. "Cal," he said, "you ride with your brother."
"I rode with him last time," Cal said.
Whether or not this was true, no one could say. And what constituted last time, anyway? The last time in the car? The last time on a trip? They never took trips.
"So, you'll ride with him this time, too."
Bert threw his bag in the back and swung the door shut. Cal looked around. Albie was darting toward the girls, poking them lightly with his index finger and making them scream. All four of the girls blurred together in Cal's mind. His own sisters, his stepsisters. It was hard to single out one of them to take the fall. Then Cal looked at Beverly. Her purple striped t-shirt, her long yellow hair curled and brushed into stylish order, her sunglasses big as a movie star's.
"Make her,"
he said to his father. Bert looked at his oldest child, and then his wife.
"Make her what?"
"Make her ride with him. Make her sit in the way back." Bert smacked Cal with his open hand. It made a sound, but it was hardly a serious blow. It only glanced off the side of his head. Cal stumbled back to make it look worse than it was. He'd taken harder hits at school, and this one was worth it, just to see what little color Beverly had drain out of her face. Cal could tell that for a split second she hadn't known whose side Bert would be on, and she had seen herself riding all the way to Lake Anna in the back seat with Albie, and she had died. Bert said he was sick of all the horseshit. He told them to get in the car. And they did it. Even Beverly. Silently and with grave bitterness. On the road, Bert kept the window down, his elbow pointing out toward the rolling hills, and said nothing. 3 hours later, when they got to the Arrowhead Diner, he had everyone line up and count off, Cal being one, Caroline being two, Holly being three.
"We're not the goddamn Trap Family Singers," Cal said under his breath.
Franny looked up at him with a mixture of fear and disbelief. He had taken the name of God in vain. That was a big one.
"You can't swear," she said.
Bert could swear, even though it was a bad idea. But children could never swear. She was sure of that. Even in the summer, she was a Sacred Heart girl. Cal, both the oldest and the tallest of the children, put his right hand on the top of her head and, curling his fingers down towards her ears, squeezed. It wasn't as hard as he would have squeezed the head of one of his real sisters, but still, he maintained control. Caroline, being the oldest of the girls, got to decide who would share beds at the Pine Cone, and at dinner made the pronouncement that she would sleep with Holly. That meant Franny got Jeanette. Franny liked Jeanette. She liked Holly, too, as far as that was concerned. She just didn't want to sleep with Caroline, who was not above trying to smother her with a pillow in the middle of the night. The boys got their own room and each his own bed. At 7 o'clock that night, the parents began to fidget and yawn, and then announced that they were exhausted, it was bedtime, and there would be fun in the morning. But what the children got in the morning was a note slipped under the door of the girls' room. Have breakfast in the coffee shop. You can charge it. We're sleeping late. Do not knock. It was their mother's handwriting, but the note was not signed Love or even Mommy. It wasn't signed at all. One more document in the ever-growing mountain of evidence that they were on their own. Every door in the long row of bright blue doors at the Pine Cone was closed, and the drapes over every window were pulled together. The cars parked in front of the rooms were wet with dew, or maybe it had rained during the night. The girls stood outside and knocked on Cal's door, the one to the right of theirs. Cal opened the door a crack. He kept the chain on and looked out at her with a single eye. "We're going to breakfast," Holly said. "Come or don't come." Cal closed the door, took off the chain, and opened it again. Behind him, they saw Albie sitting on his double bed watching cartoons, his feet rhythmically kicking the end of the mattress. Whenever any of the girls thought to complain that there were four of them in a room sharing two beds, they thought of Cal sharing the room with Albie. Cal shared a room with Albie at home, so maybe he was used to it, but probably not. "Let's go," Cal said. Cal was built on his father's model. He was a tan boy with tan hair, and in the summer both the boy and his hair took on an undertone of gold. Cal had blue eyes, his father's eyes, while the other three had dark eyes like their mother. Albie may have looked a little bit like freckled Holly, but Holly's good sense and Albie's lack of it scrubbed out any physical resemblance between them. All four of the children were thin, but Jeanette was too thin to look like any of them. She was never described by her pretty face or her hair, which was glossy and the color of dark honey. Jeanette was referenced only by her elbows and knees, which did, in fact, resemble doorknobs. When the six of them were together, they looked more like a day camp than a family. Random children dropped off on the same curb. There was very little evidence of their relation, even among those who were related by blood. "They'll sleep until noon," Holly said, meaning the parents. In the diner, she pushed her eggs around in circles with her fork. "And when they do finally get up, they'll just tell us they have to take a nap," Caroline said. It was true. The parents napped like febrile toddlers. All the children nodded their heads. Cal was next to the window in the booth, and he turned away from the rest of them to stare at the road. Albie was pounding the bottom of a ketchup bottle with the flat of his palm, until finally the ketchup poured out onto his pancakes. "Jesus," Cal said and snatched the bottle away. "Can't you sit here without doing something disgusting?"
"Look,"
Albie said, and held up the pancake, dripping ketchup in front of his face. Jeanette pinned her toast to her plate with two fingers and removed the crusts with a knife. "I'm not just going to sit here all day waiting for them," Caroline said.
"What else can we do?" Franny asked,
because there wasn't anything to do. See if the motel had any board games, maybe? A deck of cards? It was still so early, just now 7 o'clock, and the sun came through the window of the diner like an invitation delivered to their table on a silver tray. It would have been a good day to swim.
"We came here to go to the lake, so we should go to the lake," Caroline said, reading her sister's mind, or half of it.
She was wearing her swimsuit under her clothes. They all were. Caroline was a lot angrier than the rest of them. It was there in her voice all the time. Then again, it could have been that Cal was the angriest, and his anger just manifested itself in different ways. Jeanette lifted her eyes from her toast.
"Let's go," she said.
It was the first thing she had said since they left Arlington the day before, and so that settled it. Why should they wait for the parents to wake up? When they did go out with the parents, the children were divided into two groups, the big kids, Cal, Caroline, and Holly, and the little kids, Jeanette, Franny, and Albie. The big kids were allowed to wander off, swim in deep water without life jackets, hike out past anyone's view, and decide what they wanted for lunch. The little kids might as well have been tied to a tree and made to eat from a single dish. The little kids were never to be trusted. With no further discussion, the six of them decided it would be better to see this as an opportunity. At the cash register, they added a six-pack of Coke and 12 candy bars to their breakfast tab, enough to see them through to lunch if necessary.
"How far is it to the lake?" Holly asked the waitress who was ringing them up.
"Maybe 2 miles, a little less. You just get back on Route 98.
"What if you walk?"
The waitress studied the children for a minute. So many of them looked to be exactly the same size. Franny and Jeanette were 38 days apart in age.
"Where are your parents?"
"Getting dressed," Caroline said in the voice of a bored child. "They want us to all walk together. They said it's going to be an adventure. We're supposed to get directions."
The other children beamed at her for lying so deftly. The waitress took a paper placemat off the stack and turned it over.
"There's a shortcut if you walk."
On the end of the placemat, she drew a rectangle to represent the motel, which she labeled P, and on the other end, she drew a circle for the lake, L. The broken line she drew to connect the two was their ticket out. In the parking lot, Cal tried all the doors to the locked station wagon. Franny asked him what he needed out of the car, and he said, "Something. Mind your own business." He cupped his hands around his eyes and peered in the window, trying to see whatever it was he wanted.
"I can break in," Caroline said, "if it's something you really need."
"Liar," Cal said, not bothering to look at her.
"I can," she said, and then she pointed at Jeanette. "Go get me a coat hanger out of the closet."
It was true. Their father had shown them how that very summer. Their uncle, Joe Mike, had locked his keys in Aunt Bonnie's car when they were all at their grandparents' house that last weekend, and their father had unlocked the door with a coat hanger to save Joe Mike the $12 it would have cost him to call a locksmith. After that, Fix had both girls practice because they were interested. He said it was a good thing to know.
"The mistake people make is that they think they're supposed to pull up on something, and you're not. You push down," he told them.
Caroline set about untwisting the wire hanger. That was the hardest part.
"You're wasting time," Cal said.
"Whose time?" Holly said. "If you're in such a hurry, then go."
She was curious, and it was plain to all of them that Cal was curious, too. Albie walked in wide circles around the car, swinging his hips from side to side and doing the boom-boom thing.
"Pipe down," Cal said to him. "If you wake Dad up, he'll take your head off."
That was when the rest of them remembered whose room the car was parked in front of and made a point to be quiet. Caroline picked back the rubber seal at the bottom of the window with her pointer finger and stuck the coat hanger in while the other children pressed close to watch. Caroline was a little worried that locks might be different from one car to another. The station wagon was an Oldsmobile, and Aunt Bonnie's car was something else, a Dodge, maybe. The tip of her tongue pushed up at the corner of her mouth while she guided the coat hanger blindly towards what her father called the sweet spot, about 10 inches down from the button lock. Then she felt it, the wire against the mechanism of the lock. She didn't try to hook it, though the temptation was there. It was just a little bump, and she pushed straight down the way she'd been taught. The lock popped up. It was a victory for all the girls that they remembered not to scream. Caroline pulled the coat hanger out and opened the door like it was some sort of natural act. Even Albie put his arms around her waist.
"You broke the car,"
he said, his loud whisper making him sound like a movie gangster.
"That's right,"
she said, and gave him the hanger as the morning's souvenir. Albie immediately went to the car next to theirs and began jamming the hanger down against the window. Oh, what Caroline wouldn't have given to call her father from the motel phone. She wanted him to know what a good job she'd done. Cal took the coat hanger from his brother and studied it in light of this new potential. "You can teach me how to do this," he said, either to Caroline or the coat hanger.
"Only police officers are allowed to do it," Franny said, "and their children. Otherwise, you're a criminal."
"I'd be a criminal," Cal said.
He slid into the front seat of the station wagon, opened the glove compartment. He took out a gun and a fifth of gin, the seal still on. No one was surprised that there was a gun in the car, even though Cal was the only one who'd known it was there, and he only knew about it because he'd been nosing around in the glove compartment a few days before while Beverly was in the grocery store, and he'd found it, proving yet again that sometimes a person just has to look. What surprised all of them, though, Cal included, was that Bert had left it in the car. It made them think he must have another gun in his motel room. Bert liked a gun in his briefcase, in the nightstand, in the drawer of his office desk. He liked to talk about the criminals he had put away, and how a person never knew, and how he had to protect his family, and how he wasn't going to let the other guy make the first move. But really, it was just that Bert liked guns. The mesmerizing item was the gin. The parents might enjoy a drink every now and then, but it wasn't like they had to take it with them. They had never seen gin in the car before. That was something special.
"You know you can't take it," Holly said, looking back to the door of the parents' room. She was talking about both the gun and the gin.
"Just in case something happens," Cal said.
He put the gun in the brown paper sack along with the candy bars and Cokes. Jeanette had taken her Coke and two candy bars out of the bag already and put them in her purse. She took the bottle from her brother and started working on the seal, teasing it loose so gently that it finally gave itself up to her little fingernails in a single, replaceable piece. She put the seal in her coin purse and gave the bottle back to her brother. Then they set out for the lake, Caroline carrying the map. It was hotter than they expected it to be, though no hotter than it had been the day before or the day before that. The sky was already turning white, clamping a pervasive dullness onto the landscape. Holly scratched at her arms and complained about the mosquitoes. Like her stepmother, she was particularly sensitive to mosquitoes. The grass in the field across from the motel, the field that the waitress had told them to cut through, came up to their waists and was as high as Albie's chest. But being right up in it, they could see the tiny flecks of yellow flowers blooming on the stalks.
"Can you see the lake?" Albie asked.
He had ketchup smeared across the blue and yellow striped shirt that Beverly had bought for him. His hands were sticky.
"Stop,"
Cal said, and put up his hand flat to the sky. They stopped like soldiers all at once.
"Turn around,"
he said, and they turned around.
"What's that building right there?"
Cal was talking to his brother, pointing just across the street.
"The pine cone,"
Albie said.
"How far did she say it was from the pine cone to the lake?"
In the quiet, they could hear the cars whizzing past. Deep in the grass, the crickets rubbed their wings together. The birds called out overhead.
2 miles, maybe a little less,"
Franny said. She knew it wasn't her question to answer, but she couldn't stop herself. There was something about standing there that was making her uneasy, the dry weeds pricking at her shins. There was no path through the field. Cal pointed at his brother. It was funny the way he could be so much like his father while being nothing like him at all.
"Albie?"
2 miles,
Albie said. He started chopping at the grass with his open hand and then began swinging his arm back and forth like a scythe.
"So you know we're not there, and you know I can't see the lake."
Cal started walking again, and the rest of them pushed ahead. The field was bigger than it had looked from a distance, and after a while, they couldn't see the pine cone anymore, and they couldn't see anything else either, just the grass and the washed-out sky. Several members of the party wondered if they were still going in the right direction.
"Are we there now?"
Albie said.
"Shut up,"
Holly said. A grasshopper the size of a baby's fist jumped up from the dry grass and attached itself to her shirt, and she screamed. Franny and Jeanette moved to the left of the pack, and when they ducked down, they were pretty sure no one could see them. They were very close, almost nose to nose, and Jeanette smiled at her before they popped back up again.
Now are we there?
Albie hopped forward, both feet together, but his progress was thwarted by the density of the grass. He looked back at his brother.
Now are we there?
Cal stopped again.
I can send you back.
He looked behind them. There was still the beaten-down vestige of the trail they had made in the grass.
Where are we?
Albie asked.
Virginia,
Cal said, his voice as tired as an adult's.
Shut up.
I want to carry the gun,
Albie said.
People in hell want ice water,
Caroline said. It was an expression of her father's.
Cal's got a gun,
Albie sang, his voice surprisingly loud in the open landscape.
Cal's got a gun!
They stopped again. Cal moved the brown bag higher up under his arm. Two swallows came from nowhere and shot past them. Albie wouldn't stop singing. Jeanette pulled the can of Coke out of her purse.
It's too early to drink it,
Holly said. She was in her first year of Girl Scouts, and she had read the chapter about survival tactics in the handbook.
You have to make it last.
Jeanette cracked the can open anyway. Watching her drink, they all decided they were thirsty. There would be more Cokes once they got to the lake.
Cal's got a gun,
Albie called, though with less interest. Holly looked up at the sky. It was a complete blank. There wasn't a single cloud to offer them protection.
I wish I had a tic-tac, she said.
Cal thought for a minute and then nodded his head. He reached into his back pocket and pulled out a tiny plastic bag about the size of 3 postage stamps where he kept the Benadryl tablets his mother made him carry for his allergy. They all sat down, pushing back the grass, and Caroline opened up the brown bag. She was very formal about the way she picked up the gun and set it beside her, and then she handed out the Cokes. Cal came behind her and gave everyone 2 garish pink pills.
I shouldn't give you any, he said to Albie. You're annoying the hell out of me today.
But Albie kept his palm up in silent demand until finally Cal sighed and gave him his 2.
This is what I needed,
Holly said, having brought the pills up to her mouth and then brought them down again, pressed beneath her thumb. She took the bottle of gin out of the bag and swigged it like Coke, but it surprised her. For a second, she almost spit it out, but she managed to keep her lips pressed together. She handed the bottle to her sister and then stretched out on her back.
Now I won't mind walking to the lake, Holly said.
Jeanette took a hit of gin and coughed. Then she leaned over and gave her pills to Albie.
You can have mine.
He looked at the 2 extra pills in his palm. Now he had 4. They were so pink in the bright light, in a background of so much colorless grass.
Why?
He said. Maybe suspicious and maybe not. Jeanette shrugged.
Tic-tacs, give me a stomachache.
This was possible. Everything gave Jeanette a stomachache. That's why she was so thin. Franny watched Caroline, how she pushed the pills into her palm with her thumb, and then threw back her head as if to swallow them with a big slug of Coke. Caroline was always convincing. Franny could see she didn't really drink the gin, either. Her mouth wasn't open when she tilted the bottle back. But when the bottle came to her, Franny decided she would compromise, swallow the gin, and palm the pills. The gin could not have surprised her more. She followed the burning sensation as it went down her throat and through her chest and stomach. It was as hot and bright as the sun, settling between her legs, a beautiful sensation, as if the burning had brought about a sort of physical clarity. She took a second mouthful before handing the bottle to Albie. Albie drank the most of all. The children didn't mind waiting. Waiting was all part of it. It was hot outside and the Coke was still cold. It was nice just to lie there for a while and stare up into the emptiness of the sky, to not have to listen to Albie go on and on about nothing. When they finally got up, Cal put his empty Coke can next to Albie's leg.
That's littering, Franny said.
We'll pick them up later, he said. We'll have to come back for him.
So they all left their cans beside Albie, who was sleeping the sleep of 4 Benadryls and a big slug of gin in the hot morning sun. Cal took back the other pills from Holly and his stepsisters and put them in the baggie and put the baggie back in his pocket. The candy bars were starting to melt, and the gun was hot from being out in the sun, and they put them all together back in the bag and headed for the lake. When they got there, the 5 of them swam out farther than they ever would have been allowed to had the parents been with them. Franny and Jeanette went to look for caves and were taught to fish by 2 men they met standing off by themselves in a grove of trees on the shore. Cal stole a package of ho-hos from the bait shop and had no need to use the gun in the paper bag because no one saw him do it. Caroline and Holly climbed to the top of a high rock and leapt into the lake below again and again and again until they were too tired to climb anymore, too tired to swim. All of them were sunburned, but they lay in the grass to dry because none of them had thought to bring a towel. But the drying off bored them, and so they decided to head back. Their timing turned out to be perfect. Albie was awake, but he was just sitting there in the field, quiet and confused amid the Coke cans, trying hard not to cry. He didn't ask them where they had been or where he was. He just got up and followed in the line behind them as they passed. He was sunburned as well. It was just past 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The most amazing thing of all was that minutes after they came back to the pine cone and stretched across the beds in the girls' room in their damp swimsuits to watch television, the parents knocked on their door, bashful and apologetic. They couldn't believe how long they'd slept. They had no idea how tired they must have been. They would take everyone to the movies and out to pizza in order to make it up to them. The parents seemed not to notice the swimsuits, the sunburns, the mosquito bites. The cousins' children and the Keating children smiled up with beatific forgiveness. They had done everything they had ever wanted to do. They had had the most wonderful day, and no one even knew they were gone. It was like that for the rest of the summer. It was like that every summer the 6 of them were together. Not that the days were always fun. Most of them weren't. But they did things, real things, and they never got caught. Chapter 4. The music didn't change. The tape churned out the same 2-hour loop again and again. The management figured that either the customer would have paid up and left or be too drunk to notice before the songs began to repeat. A person would have to stay in the bar, sober and attentive, for more than 2 hours before realizing that George Benson was singing this masquerade for a second time. That meant the only people who could be troubled by the repetition were the people who worked in the bar, and the standard of sobriety and attention knocked several of them out of the running. During the course of an 8-hour shift, an employee could expect to hear the tape 4 times in its entirety, 4.5 for whoever was closing. Franny spoke to Fred about it at the end of her first month. Fred, the better of the 2 night managers, oversaw the bar and the larger, busier, and less profitable hotel restaurant. He told her it didn't matter. "It does matter," Franny said. "It's driving me batshit." She was wearing a slim black dress, sleeveless and short, over a fitted white blouse. She was wearing black, high-heeled shoes. With her straight blonde hair in a single loose braid, she looked like the music video version of the Catholic schoolgirl she'd once been. Before she took the job, she wasn't sure if she'd be able to bear the indignity of the uniform, but it turned out the uniform didn't actually bother her. It was the music. It was Sinatra singing "It Was a Very Good Year" that made her feel like she might step into the revolving door at the front of the lobby, a tray of cocktails balanced on her open hand, and swing out into the dark winter night. Fred gave her a nod. He was not paternalistic or dismissive, though he looked like somebody's father and gave her an answer that was in no way helpful. "Trust me, I've been here almost 5 years. You get used to it."
But I don't want to be here in 5 years. I don't want to get used to it.
The smallest flash of discomfort registered in the night manager's eyes. Franny tried again.
Couldn't you just get a couple of different tapes? It could be the same people. I'm not complaining about the kind of music. I mean, different music would be appreciated, but that's not my problem. The repetition is my problem. Those people sang other songs.
We have more tapes somewhere, Fred said, glancing around the tiny windowless office. But no one ever changes them.
I could change them.
He pushed up from his cluttered desk and gave her shoulder a small, conciliatory squeeze. Everyone in this place was a toucher. The waitresses kissed at the end of their shifts. The managers rested their hands on your shoulders. A busboy, not correctly tipped, could deliver a forceful hip check when squeezing past you at the dishwash station. And the customers, Jesus, the customers liked to touch. 2 years in law school, and not a single person had put a finger on her. But that was law school, where everyone who had made it through the first 2 weeks understood the concept of liability. Standing this close, she could just catch the smallest trace of vodka in the air around Fred, and was surprised that she could still register the smell of alcohol.
Just wait, he said, his voice full of reassurance. It goes away.
Franny trudged down the narrow hallway from the office to the kitchen where the cooks played bootleg cassettes of NWA on a boombox coated in grease. The volume so low it barely whispered above the clanging of pots. Fuck the police. The men mouthed the words and bobbed their heads, all within the low limits of the management's tolerance.
Little house, Jarell called to her from the line. Be sweet and get me some lemonade.
He reached across the searing cooktop and through the pickup window to hand her his jumbo styrofoam 7-Eleven cup with lid and straw.
Sure,
Franny said. She took the cup. The cooks, every one of them a large black man, were reliant on the waitresses, every one of them a small white woman, to bring drinks back from the bar to keep them from dying in the Sahara of the fry station.
I count on you,
Jarell said, and pointed at her with a raw steak before dropping the meat on the incandescent surface in front of him. But Franny never forgot the lemonade, nor how many extra packets of sugar he liked, nor the bar pretzels needed to make up for the body's lost salt, flushed away in the rivers of sweat that dropped onto the cooktop with an explosive sizzle and vanished. She knew what every man in the kitchen wanted in his cup. Franny was a professional. She remembered orders for tables of 10, who got the Kettle One, who got the Absolute. She could soothe a single businessman without letting him monopolize her time. Stepping out into the frozen slap of Chicago in the small hours of the morning, it was not lost on her how much better it would have been to have been a bad cocktail waitress and a good law student. She had dropped out of law school in the middle, though closer to the beginning, of the first semester of her third year. She had racked up an enormous debt predicated on the salary of the partnership she would never obtain. For someone who had no skills and no idea what she wanted to do with her life other than read, cocktail waitressing was the most money she could make while keeping her clothes on. Those were her only two criteria at this point, not to be a lawyer and to keep her clothes on. She had tried regular waitressing, wearing black sneakers and hoisting trays of food, but there wasn't enough money in it to cover the minimum payments in her coupon book. In the dark, velvety plush of the Palmer House bar, men regularly, inexplicably, left $2.20 sitting on top of an $18 check. She filled the styrofoam cup with crushed ice and lemonade, and seeing that Heinrich the bartender was listening to a customer outline the seven sorrows of the world, laced the frozen slush with Cointreau. Cointreau was the bottle at the very end of the bar near the soda station, and was therefore the easiest to snatch. Plus, she thought it made a certain sense with lemonade. She would have paid for the shot, but employees were not allowed to buy alcohol during their shift, and they were especially not allowed to buy alcohol for the men who operated the knives and heated surfaces. Jarell had told her he'd give her $10 anytime she could get something extra in the cup, but she wouldn't take his money, This, too, made her a sort of mythical creature among the members of the kitchen staff, because while other waitresses would take drink orders from the cooks, they often forgot to fill them. And when they did remember, they never turned down a tip. Franny ran torch law in her head in an effort to block out the music, covering the thing she hated with the thing she despised. The elements of assault. The act was intended to cause apprehension of harmful or offensive contact, and the act indeed caused apprehension in the victim that harmful or offensive contact would occur. The night was winding down. The high tide of gin and tonics had receded into the quiet ebb of after-dinner drinks. Snifters of brandy and small, syrupy glasses of Frangelico purchased by customers who realized they weren't quite drunk enough to go up to their rooms. It was Franny's night to close, and for the moment, she'd been left alone to oversee the room. Two tables of two, and one lone soul at the bar. Both of the other cocktail waitresses clocked out, one to pick up her sleeping child from her ex-husband's couch, and the other to have drinks with a Palmer House waiter in some less expensive bar. They had both kissed Franny before they left, and then they kissed each other. She guessed that Heinrich had gone to smoke in the hallway outside the kitchen, which gave Franny the chance to slip around to the other side of the bar and step out of her shoes. She flexed her toes back before grinding them down against the damp honeycomb of the black rubber bar mat. Then she ate three maraschino cherries from the garnish bins, along with an orange slice, because they were best when chewed up together. That was what she was doing when she saw Leon Posen, her mouth full of chemically altered fruit. She should only have had a glimpse of him, but when he looked up, she had neither the opportunity nor the will to turn away.
"Hello," he said.
Leon Posen, sitting two seats away from her. He was wearing a dark gray suit and a white shirt with only the top button of his collar undone. He may well have had a tie folded in his pocket. Had he reached out his hand and she reached out her hand, their fingers very easily could have touched. As a rule, Franny didn't pay attention to the people at the bar. They were people who had chosen not to take a table and therefore were not her responsibility. She had no idea how long he'd been sitting there. 10 minutes? An hour? "Hello," she said.
"You're shorter than you were," he said.
"Am I?"
"You've taken off your shoes."
Franny looked down at the sore red curve bitten into the top of either foot, clearly visible through her stockings. It was an impression that stayed for hours after she was home. "Yes." He nodded. His hair was iron gray, sheep-like. Efforts must have gone into combing it down.
"It's a nice effect, but I think it would destroy your feet after a while."
"You get used to it," Franny said, and thought of Fred and how he had told her she'd get used to it. She made herself listen now as a way of orienting herself in the world, in the bar where she stood across from Leon Posen. Lou Rawls was singing "Nobody But Me," which was funny because that was the one song in the rotation she never got tired of. The perfect union of nouns and verbs. "I've got no chauffeur to chauffeur me. I've got no servant to serve my tea." Leon Posen nodded, his fingertips resting on a drained glass of ice. Franny was shaping the story in her head even as he was sitting in front of her. She was thinking of how she would pull out her copies of First City and Septimus Porter as soon as she got home. She would go back over the part she had underlined in college and read them again. Then she would wake Kumar up and tell him she had talked to Leon Posen in the bar and how he had asked her about her shoes. Kumar, who was a genius when it came to not being interested in anything, would want to hear every detail, and when she was finished, he would tell her to start again. Even as it was happening, she knew that the story of meeting Leon Posen at the Palmer House was one she was going to tell for a long time. "If I hadn't gone to law school in Chicago and then dropped out, I wouldn't even have been working in the bar." She would tell that to her father and to Bert. But Leon Posen hadn't finished. He was still in front of her, waiting for her attention while she imagined him.
Why get used to it?
What? She had lost her place in the conversation. The shoes. He looked like his pictures, the nose taking up all the real estate, and then the soft, hooded eyes. His face was a caricature of his face, a face that was meant to be sketched beside a book review in The New Yorker.
Well, you have to. The shoes are part of the uniform, and you wear the uniform because you make more money.
And though she wouldn't mention it, the uniform was polyester, which you can laugh at all you want, but it washed really well and didn't need to be ironed. Franny never had to figure out what she was supposed to wear to work, which had also been the great thing about Catholic school.
You mean I'll tip you more for wearing uncomfortable shoes?
You will, she said, because she'd been there long enough to know how things work. You do. He looked at her sadly, or maybe that was just the way he looked, as if he felt the pain of every woman who had ever crammed her feet into heels. It was a beguiling effect.
Well, I haven't tipped you yet, so if that's the reason, you might as well put your shoes back on. We could see what happens.
I'm not your waitress, she said, regretting it deeply. Leon Posen, step away from the bar. Come and sit at one of the little tables with the flickering candles. Make yourself comfortable in the round red leather chairs.
You could be if I ordered another drink.
He held up his glass, rattled the lonesome ice.
What's your name?
She told him her name.
I never meet Franny's.
He said it like her name was a favor to him.
Franny, I'd like another scotch.
It was her job to get him a drink if he was sitting at a table, but not if he was sitting at the bar. They were not union workers at the Palmer House, but the Division of Labor was ironclad. She knew her place.
What kind of scotch?
He smiled at her again, two smiles.
Dealer's choice, he said. And remember, I may be that rare individual who tips off the percentage of the bill instead of your heel height. So knock yourself out.
She had just worked her left foot back into the shoe when Heinrich, fresh from his cigarette and breath mint, rounded the edge of the bar and came towards them. He was raising two fingers to Leon Posen, a gesture that asked if he was ready for another without troubling himself to form the question into words, as if theirs was a relationship so sacred it had transcended language. Franny, stepping out of her left shoe as she rushed to cut him off, all but threw herself into the bartender, who in turn was forced to catch her. He looked down at her stocking feet. Heinrich was a man of Leon Posen's age, her father's age, which was to say somewhere in the dark woods past 50. He came from a more decorous time. She had no business being behind the bar in the first place. She knew that. It was his country. I need a favor, she said. It was easy to be quiet. She was in his arms. Heinrich turned to Leon Posen and raised his eyebrows slightly,